Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have a number of bills up today for public hearing as well as possible work sessions on some other bills and some of those that are set for public hearing. What I plan to do today is I'll have to carry over three bills from last Thursday. Those three are going to be heard first because I don't think it's appropriate for them. Those who were here on Thursday have come back to have to wait a second time. So what we're going to do is we're going to start at then for the order that we're going to be going through. We'll start with Senate Bill 421, then Senate Bill 731, and then followed by Senate Bill 740. And then from there we'll regroup and probably take our other public hearings, which will then be appropriate by the time since we can't do a few of them until after 8:45. So with that, let's go ahead and open up our first public hearing, continuation, or I should say carryover from last Thursday, Senate Bill 421.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 421 limits the causes of action based on negligence against design professionals for work done on improvements to the person with whom the design professional contracted, defines design professional, exempts tort claim for personal injury, death, or damage to property other than improvement, applies retroactively. Senate Bill 421 responds to an Oregon Supreme Court decision in Harris v. Suniga, which allowed a negligence claim of property damage filed by a subsequent property owner to proceed against a builder where the parties had no prior relationship. Under Senate Bill 421, a claim of property damage against a design professional for negligent work on an improvement cannot be sustained unless it is brought by the party who contracted with the design professional.
All right, thank you. What I'm going to do is I have one individual that signed up as a proponent. I believe it's John Larson. John, why don't you go ahead and come forward? And then I have four other people that have signed up. These are carryovers. I don't know if these individuals are actually signed up today or they were carried over from last Thursday. These are today's? Okay. John.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Larson, and I am an attorney. I've been practicing law since 1989, and I have an emphasis in practicing in construction law with a sub-emphasis in representing designers. By that, I mean architects and engineers generally. I want to talk a little bit about the problem that this bill is attempting to address, and I will try to be brief, but if I go past something that you have a question about, I'm sure you will let me know and bring me back to it. Basically, the issue is this. Designers almost always spend a very large amount of time and energy and mental duress going through a contract negotiation before they decide to work on a project. And that contract negotiation results in a contract between the designer and typically the owner of the project that establishes the party's obligations under the contract, the risks, the responsibilities, and the financial realities of that contract. The biggest component that I see, and I help clients negotiate these contracts, are the apportionment of the responsibilities. And in the design contract, this is called the scope of work. And owners typically don't want the designers to do everything that the designers could possibly do. And in fact, negotiate down the scope of work that the designers will perform on the project for a reduced fee from the designers. I think that makes some common sense. The problem, however, is that the designers can't make the owners do everything that the designers think is wise and prudent. A typical example of this is after a design has been prepared, the project gets underway, is under construction, and the designer would have liked to have spent more time doing what's called construction administration, site observations, to see how the project is actually going together. That's an expense that is typically the first line item cut in the budget by the owner. And as a result, during the course of the project, even though the designer may have prepared fantastic, perfect plans, that designer has no way of knowing whether those plans are actually being followed in the field. Years down the road, a problem develops, and it turns out that some subcontractor failed to put proper flashing around a window, condos leak, and there's all sorts of damage resulting, and it's blamed, at least in part, on the designer for failing to catch it during the one time a month that he was on the site. So that's the problem that I see. The reality is that designers are being sued by subsequent homeowners or owners of projects who don't have any contractual privity with the designers and therefore don't understand that the designer's scope of work under the contract was severely limited. And what this bill is attempting to do is to say that unless there's a contract between the parties, then you can't sue the designers. I think it's fairly straightforward in there, in that approach. Last week, when we showed up for this hearing, and I was here last Thursday, I had an opportunity to talk to some folks out in the hall, and I think Mr. Chandler here will confirm that. We think that there is an approach that is different than is reflected in the bill. Basically, our concern, the designer's concern, American Council of Engineering Companies, is concerned about being able to enforce those hard-fought contractual provisions in subsequent litigation. And maybe the approach, and John and I were talking about this, is to simply say that if there is a later suit by a subsequent owner, whether it's a homeowner or somebody buys a shopping mall 10 years down the road, rather than barring that claim because of lack of privity, as the bill currently says, to say something along the lines of, no, if you're going to sue the designer, then you're going to be bound by the terms of that designer's contract. When that designer agreed to do a limited scope of work, then that's going to be the basis of the claim against the designer, whether they fail to meet that agreed-upon scope of work. So that's the approach that I think John and Mr. Chandler and I are suggesting.
All right, let me do this. And John, second John, that is. I apologize. I didn't realize we saw the bracketing. We thought the last four was to come up together. So understand this is actually the John and John show. But before you go forward, what I just heard, and I think what we talked about maybe last week, this looks like it's ripe for a little work group, and we're going to see if we can't get those who are going to give us testimony today to maybe get together and see if we can't work something out that everyone seems to work appropriately. So with that, what I'd like for you to do is just put on what you need to put on the record now, understanding we are going to have a work group, and that's going to be for the next three. I do want to know what the opposition is and the issues, so we'll have those on the record, and then we can figure out where the work group goes or doesn't. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. As Mr. Larson mentioned, we did talk last week. We don't like the bill as written. We think there may be a path to get the bill fixed in a way that we could support. The problem he's identified is a fairly common one in the construction industry where you have written contracts, subsequent purchasers, and subsequent tort claims. We think there might be a path here that we can help my clients as well as Mr. Larson's, and we look forward to coming back and chatting with you about it.
All right, thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our last panel at this point, I believe it's Mike Ellison, Tom Lawler, and Dean Otteridge. Gentlemen, whoever wants to get started.
Go ahead, Tom.
I'll go ahead.
Okay. My name always gets it.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dean Aldrich. I'm also a lawyer from Portland, Oregon, and I represent owners in disputes with design professionals. I also have a degree in civil engineering. I've had some experience in the construction industry. I was here 2 years ago with this exact bill, which was at that time called Senate Bill 955. I'm a member of OTLA, and I'm making comments in opposition. First, I want to talk about practical implications, then I'll go with legal implications, and then I'll move to solution. The practical implications are design professionals are an integral part of the construction process. When a construction professional makes a mistake, violates the standard of care, it can have tremendous consequences, landslides, collapses, water intrusions, so forth. What this bill does is it takes a remedy away from a class of persons who don't have the ability as Mr. Larson says, to contract with that design professional. Instead, uses the common law. And basically, the common law is, if you're negligent, you should be responsible. You can't contract away your negligence except in certain limited circumstances. The Oregon Constitution allows that every citizen of this state has a remedy for property damage in negligence. So getting onto the legal implications, this bill violates the Oregon Constitution. Secondly, it violates recent Oregon Supreme Court law authority that states that a person can be held responsible for property damage for their negligence, whether there's a contract or not. And those two cases are Harris, which came out a couple of years ago, I think right before we had the hearing on this bill 2 years ago, and then Abraham, which just came out a couple of weeks ago. And that those two cases confirmed long-standing Oregon law that if you screw up, you need to be responsible for it. Furthermore, and this gets into a bit of an issue that Mr. Larson was raising, is there are certain laws and regulations. Oregon statutes require that design professionals act for the safety of the public and property. And regardless of how they, if they don't have Mr. Larson representing them in contract negotiations and they let the owner beat up on them, take away their scope, they are still violating Oregon law if they're not meeting the standard of care. So this bill has a problem with the current statutory and regulatory scheme with architects. And furthermore, if the situation comes up where Mr. Larson talked about, where the owner, trying to save costs, has the design professional take a less active role in supervision of the construction on commercial projects, that design professional has an obligation to write to the engineer board or the architect board and say, hey, my owner's not letting me come and make sure that this project is built in accordance with my drawings, which is also a code requirement that the projects have to be built in accordance with the drawings. And I think the solution to this problem, I don't think is a workout. I don't think it is a legislative solution. I think it just comes down to design professionals, one, doing a good job, having appropriate training and quality control, and then also not kowtowing to developers or other folks who want to cut their costs. They have a statutory duty to the public, and that needs to be upheld regardless of what their contract is, so they need to be strong in their contract negotiations. So I think it's a matter of that. I had a meeting with Mr. Dave Simmons, a representative of the engineering folks, last year, and I basically said that. It comes down to business management and so forth. This isn't a legislative fix. Thank you very much. I urge you to oppose or deny this bill.
All right, thank you.
Go ahead.
Whoever wants to go next.
My name is Thomas Lauer. I'm the Major Projects Manager for ODOT, and I'm here to express the concerns of the agency on this bill. Over the past several years, and in fact in 2003, the Oregon Legislature directed the agency to contract out the delivery of the OTIA 3 of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act Bridge Delivery Program. And in that, we contracted some $1.3 billion. That was delivered via a joint partnership, which then subcontracted all the design work to multiple design professionals throughout the state of Oregon. In a couple of years, that design entity, that joint partnership, will cease to exist. And the remedy of the agency to pursue any negligent issues on a design through that contract will no longer exist, as the primary partner will no longer be there. We face the same problem on many of the innovative contracting we do on design build, where the A&E firm, the architectural and engineering firm, will be contracted via the contractor and not through the agency directly. So if and when that contractor no longer exists as an entity, the path for us to seek remedy under this bill would be eliminated. In addition, the agency experiences a great number of improvements on the highway system that are delivered either via local governments, but particularly our concern is with private developers for shopping malls, other things of that nature, who have to make improvements on the public highway system. Often the joint ventures and various legal entities that develop those projects don't exist far beyond the life of the development of the mall or whatever. And then again, our ability to seek remedy with them would be highly limited. In addition, we're also faced with a unique issue within the agency that we have a great deal of pass-through money from the federal government that comes to the agency that's targeted for local governments. In those cases, the agency is the primary contractor for A&E services to local governments. Those facilities exist completely on the local government system. And if that agency was to find, any of our local agencies at some point were to find a deficiency, their remedy would be then to sue the agency so that they can then pursue their issue with the design firm, only causing ODOT to have additional legal expenses as a pass-through agent for that claim. So we have many concerns about the varied forms that we contract with A&E firms, which is a large volume business for the agency. If the legislature believes that this bill is good policy and needs to be advanced, ODOT suggests that public agencies be exempted from it so that we can continue to pursue negligence in the interest of the taxpayers of the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Lauer has hit on some of the concerns that we have, which is simply if the department is doing work on a county right-of-way and contracting with an engineer. Again, our recourse, only recourse, may be to bring the department into litigation in order to get to the engineer, which results in a lot of needless litigation between public agencies. And then, of course, vice versa, where a county may be doing work on behalf of on a state highway project, and ODOT's only recourse may be to bring litigation against against the county. In addition, we consider design professionals to owe a duty to the public under Oregon licensing statutes, ORS Chapter 671 for architects and I believe 672 for engineers. Design professionals have a primary obligation to, quote, safeguard the health, safety, and welfare of the public, end quote. In light of this, it may be appropriate in the construction defect context for design professionals to at least answer a negligence claim by a subsequent owner who did not directly contract with the design professional. Obviously, the plaintiff would still have to prove all the elements of negligence, duty, breach, causation, actual loss, but it might be appropriate, as the courts have found, for a design professional to answer that negligence claim. And then lastly, you know, we don't have to look too far down the road, just to the Marion County Courthouse Square, to know that mistakes sometimes do occur, and regardless of who is ultimately at fault for that building, that undoubtedly the taxpayers will be paying for that for decades. So we think it might be appropriate for the law to stay as it is in this context. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Question for Mr. Lauer. If this law had been in effect, would it have limited your ability to find remedy on Shady Bridge?
I do not remember the exact path of contracting on that project, so I can't answer that question, and I will. And if the contract is through the agency, we would pursue it through the contract means. If the contract was not held by the agency, we wouldn't. Now, we have other projects where we have had issues which have been design build projects, and if we identify the issues, and we have during any point of the active contract, we pursue it through that means. The challenge would be if we were to find a latent defect or negligence some years downstream, how would we pursue it in that case? But we go to the most immediate and easiest remedy possible, and if it's an active ongoing contract that has not been closed, we pursue it through those means.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, you're familiar with that. There's huge liability issues potentially here.
Yep. Yeah, there's multiple projects that the state's engaged in, including the highway that goes to the coast, Eddyville area as well. Senator Wessex, do you have questions? I couldn't tell if you put your hand up or not. I'm not encouraging you to ask questions if you really don't want to.
Chair, I have a question.
All right, Senator Dingfelder first.
Thank you. Well, Senator Whitsett is pondering if he has a question or not. I'll go ahead and actually, I probably should have asked this for the previous panel, the question I have is liability insurance. I mean, everybody, I've worked with engineering firms for 25 years, professional engineering firms, planning firms. In order to practice, you've got to have a certain amount of liability insurance. So you want to comment on that about, is that not adequate? Is there concern? And maybe this is something we should be asking the design professionals as well. But
under Oregon law as it exists right now, there is no requirement for design professionals to have insurance, liability insurance. And furthermore, the liability insurance issue comes down solely to collectability. If you bring a suit against a design professional, you sue that design professional, regardless where they have insurance. If you go to trial, the issue of insurance doesn't come up at all.
Follow up?
Yes.
Most of the contracts that I've ever worked on, they're, especially if they're public contracts, there's a requirement, even though the state does not require the, as part of the contractual agreement, requirement that a certain amount of liability insurance.
You see that many times, and it's the ball is moving that way as far as private contracting, which almost my entire business is private contracting. If you have a sophisticated developer, he will require that the design professional carry a certain amount of insurance. That's not always the case, but typically you will see that in most of the large dollar cases, some of the smaller ones.
I was going to say, I'd like to hear from the counties and states. I'm assuming that's standard practice.
Yeah, Chair, Mr. Senator, yes. We do require liability insurance. The amounts vary depending on the size and scope of the project. There is always a natural challenge of the upper boundary. Some of the project ODOT goes into are fairly expensive, and getting insurance in the tens of millions of dollars is not a normal. We're generally in the 1 to 5 million range. We have gone higher when we feel there are risks and challenges that would warrant it. Often we're not able to require insurance to the full value. That challenge will exist, for example, when we deal with the Columbia River crossing. A very large project, and what is the rational upper boundary of insurance to require?
Chair Przanski, and just quickly, counties also do require insurance on all of our projects that we contract out.
And then just to follow up to that issue, regardless if this bill goes through for a certain class of owners, it doesn't matter whether the design professional has insurance or not, there would be no remedy for the defective performance.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you. A great amount of the public contracting is now done through general manager, general contractor, no-bid contracts. How did the Supreme Court ruling affect those contracts, and how would this bill change that?
With respect to a CMCG, basically the bottom line of the court's opinions, and these are two cases that dealt with contractors themselves, but basically the construction manager, so to speak, would still be liable in negligence for whatever his portion of the problem was, regardless of contract. With certain exceptions, there are ways that you can contract and produce some kind of waiver that says I won't even be responsible for my own negligence, whether that would pass muster when you have statutory duties on design professionals like we do in this state, I don't know. But those cases would just seem to confirm that, you know, if you're in the chain in a construction project, for whatever role that you do, if you're negligent, you may be held responsible. Did I answer your question?
I just wanted to short follow up. If the general contractor then had subsequently gone out of business, how would the aggrieved individual bring a tort action?
And there, now we get into the insurance issue. Under Oregon law, all general contractors are required to have liability insurance. And typically what you do if a general contractor goes bankrupt or goes out of business, you put the insurance on notice during that time period of which the loss occurs, and they come in and defend. They have a contractual, because you buy insurance for a certain period of time, they have a contractual duty to come in and defend that individual even if they're bankrupt or they're no longer in business, so long as the loss occurred during that policy period.
So the
loss occurred during the policy period or the actual construction that was inadequate occurred during the policy period?
Yeah, it's the loss. It depends on how the policies are written. Design professionals have a different type of policy, which is claims made. They have to have the policy when the claim is made. For typical general liability policies, it's when the damage to the property occurs. So it's not necessarily when the project is going on, unless damage to the property occurs then, but typically after. So it occurs, the trigger is whether there's an occurrence within the policy period, and that typically is property damage.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
If I could, one other thing to get back to these guys, I just thought about under Oregon law, too, there's a case called Waterway Terminals, a Supreme Court case that allows a contract to come in to help flesh out what the standard of care is, so that within Oregon law itself, the evidence laws allow a remedy that Mr. Larson was just talking about, where a design professional can say, well, here was my scope, this is what I do, and then the jury or the judge can take that into consideration to determine negligence. Thank you.
Don't leave yet.
Okay.
All right. Two things. Dean, I'd like for you to provide to counsel the citations of those two cases.
Okay.
Second, I asked Marshall Kobach during the summer to make contact with you to have some of the discussions. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding those discussions never occurred.
Yeah, and I do apologize for that. I had two back-to-back trials, so I was toast basically from August through near to Christmas.
All right, well, I would suggest hopefully in the future, at least the courtesy letting know what's going on. I know my counsel tried to make contact with you since session started.
Yep.
Still same results.
Yeah, and I do apologize.
Right. So here's the thing. I got you on the record for this one now. All right, so we're looking at having a work group.
Yep.
Can you participate?
Yes, I can.
All right. Anything else? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 421? Not Cindy? A little bit. Very little bit. We're having a work group, so.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I work for the American Institute of Architects. The design professionals just want to get on the record that this bill actually was not written how we intended for it to. So all the testimony you've just heard about negligence and lawsuits for negligence is not the intent of this bill, as 955 from last session showed. We're talking about the difference between tort law, contract law. We're not trying to take away tort law rights. We're trying to change the contract lawsuit rights.
All right, so take it up on the work group. Thank you very much for putting that on the record. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 421, and we're going to open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 731.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 731 modifies obligation of evidence custodians to retain biological evidence as follows. For 60 years or until death of each person convicted of aggravated murder, rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, until completion of sentence by each person convicted of aggravated vehicular homicide, manslaughter in the first degree, or manslaughter in the second degree, and until the statute of limitations has expired for charges that do not result in conviction. Requires a court to return admitted biological evidence to the responsible custodian or the defense as appropriate, provides procedure to address lost or destroyed biological evidence, prohibits reversal of conviction on sole ground that biological evidence is no longer available, requires the Attorney General to adopt rules pertaining to evidence collection in consultation with the Department of State Police and evidence custodians, provides a process for alternative disposition, repeals sunset, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are -1 amendments that remove Public Defense Service Commission from the list of persons and entities receiving notice regarding the disposition of the evidence.
All right, thank you. And this is kind of like, say, a follow-up from our last session, so whoever wants to kind of give us where we're at and how we're proceeding.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in support of Senate Bill 731. As most of you, although I recognize that Senator Cruz was not on this committee last session, this is a continuation of Senate Bill 310, which, just to briefly go back, is a continuation of the DNA innocence law that was developed in Oregon over 10 years ago that allows individuals who even after post-conviction did not have the testing available because of technology of evidence that's been retained from the crime scene to have that evidence retained. Since that time, ACLU and others have been asking the question, what happens to the evidence after conviction and post-conviction? Is there uniform practices across the state? As such, we brought Senate Bill 310 last session that would implement such uniform practices. And when there were questions raised, thankfully, Senator Prezonsky moved the bill forward as a moratorium, as a placeholder, and implemented a work group. And that work group met, and I want to take a quick moment to list all the members of the work group. And it included evidence custodians from the cities of Lake Oswego, Medford, Eugene, and Portland, two colleagues next to me, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, as well as the Oregon District Attorney's Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Counties, Cities, the Oregon State Police Forensic Service Division, the Oregon Justice Department, the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force, and you have their testimony before you in support, the Innocence Project, and the ACLU of Oregon. In addition, Representative Jeff Barker attended many of the meetings, and I really do want to take a moment to thank Cheyenne Roth, because she not only organized the meetings, but she helped guide this process, navigating the differences and identifying solutions and agreements along the way. So I really appreciate her work in this effort. The short is that this establishes a process for retaining evidence in certain crimes, murders, and the rape crimes for a set number of years, giving, I think, custodian clerks and property clerks a uniform time period. But it does provide some exceptions. It allows, if the evidence is of such bulk and nature that it is unreasonable to store that, that they can remove from that what likely contains biological evidence. It also allows a process if the custodian clerk decides or requests to the DA that the evidence be destroyed early. In those cases, there's a process set forth in the bill to allow the DA, if he or she agrees, to then send notice and the process to occur through the court system. If the district attorney does not agree, then the evidence is retained. My testimony contains a section-by-section analysis. I'm not going to go through that. I think I will basically conclude. I do want to thank everyone because I'm very pleased that we really did surmount some of the hurdles that existed last time, had a very healthy conversation. It took a number of meetings, but I'm really pleased to have these two esteemed colleagues by my side testifying in support of the ACLU proposed legislation before you today. Thank you.
You just had to say that, didn't you? Okay, Kevin or
yeah.
John?
Chair Prezonsky and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I almost brought my own camera today so you could take a picture of us testifying together. We usually don't sit in the same panels. We're usually saying yes to something, and she's usually saying no. So this is a bit of a miracle today that we sit before you supporting a bill together, but we do support Senate Bill 731. It's a good example of the result of a work group where people sit at the table to address a problem that really is in front of us. And for police agencies around the state, a clear policy regarding the retention of biological evidence is important, and we believe that this now accomplishes that purpose. We did ask for evidence custodians to be a part of this process, and Andrea already mentioned that we had four different custodians physically involved, but in addition to that, we had all our smaller agencies throughout the state also involved in reviewing these. The reason for that, of course, is that when you're talking about the retention of evidence for some smaller departments, you're talking about impacts on space and just the sheer ability to do it. Can this be managed? Can an evidence custodian work from this bill and know what they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to retain evidence without a confusion that causes harm either to those who are seeking innocence or to those who are seeking justice? And so with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do sit together today to support this bill. I don't know, that may be a reason to be concerned, but we think it's a good bill, and we appreciate the time to be before the committee today and for the effort to put us together in a work group to try to come up with a solution we can live with. Thank you.
John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing Oregon's 36 county sheriffs, who had at first some misgivings about Senate Bill 731, went through the work process that was described by Ms. Meyer and ably staffed by Cheyenne, and we were very grateful for the way she conducted those meetings. Sheriff Bergen from Clatsop County was a member of this work group and thoroughly reviewed every section, and it is a balance of protecting the rights of those who have been convicted, who may at some later date be found to be innocent due to biological evidence. And there's none of us here who would want someone imprisoned who is not guilty. So we think it strikes a balance so that we can, in fact, administer this law, and we think it's good public policy.
Thank you.
Chair, if I can just add one thing. The ACLU did request that amendments dash ones be adopted because the Public Defense Service Commission just had some questions about what to do with the notice that they received it, and so in light of moving forward, it was just easier to remove them. They're just being removed from when the DA decides that there should be a destruction of the evidence before the time, and we don't think that will even happen very often, but if it does, who receives notice? And it's the defendant and the courts and the victim, and so it really does cover, we hope, the bases. So it was simply a request we were fine to, and we think it's very minor, and hope that the bill would move forward with the dash one amendments adopted. Everyone has received a copy of them.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, I'm really not quite sure how to address this panel because it's really strange.
But
one of my favorite shows is NCIS, which and Abby is quite a character. My question basically is, are we reaching a point in time when this could be kept in computer records in a verifiable way rather than hard evidence? I mean, are we approaching that at all?
Chair Prasonsky, Senator Cruz, I know the Oregon State Police may be in the room today to answer any of those advanced questions, but I think one of the things that I will respond to that is we are moving forward, and that's why this bill, the statute, doesn't contain the methodology for how the evidence is to be retained. We leave it to the AG, who, in consultation with the Oregon State Police and custodian clerks, can continue to advance that. There's some question about, do we need to refrigerate everything? And so technology, I don't think we're down to that level that you speak of, but we are moving forward to where I think it's going to be easier, not harder, to retain the evidence that should be retained. And so that's why that flexibility with the AG work rules making is in there specifically to address your issues.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Just I think it's good public policy, but I'm struggling to understand how the preservation and the of evidence and the chain and preserving the chain of custody for evidence for 60 years can have a minimal fiscal impact. Can you help me with that?
Well, let me first address, and then I'll look in more detail. Chair Prasonsky, Senator Whitsitt, a lot of this evidence, I think, is retained for a very long time as it is. I mean, we are talking about the most serious crimes where the district attorney and the parties are going through a lot of appellate process, so we're already talking about years. And I think and for probably some degree, that evidence may not be looked at and ever destroyed. It just sits there because they know they've had to keep it for so long. But what it does allow is the custodian clerks to know after many, many years what evidence we can get rid of and what we should keep, and providing that clear guidance. And I think it was the clerks and the other folks actually who just wanted that set period of time. And we certainly talked about all of this. And it seemed easier to do the set number of years like that and make it clean and simple. And some states, and I've got the range, we're really falling in the middle. Some states actually cover every crime and retention of every crime, and some keep it for much longer. Others do a variety of things, but I think we thought this was a sound approach, and I'll let the gentleman who have to handle it speak more specifically.
Chair Prasonsky and Senator Whitsitt, it's a very good question. It's one of the reasons that there are three categories there in that initial section, and we've limited the number of crimes for which that 60-day period applies. We tried to narrow it so that it wasn't, it didn't create an undue burden. And the fact is, we do carry a lot of this evidence for a very long period of time already. And so we believe this provides certainty. One of the things that the evidence custodians said as they were participating in the work group is, tell us when and when we can't, so that we know exactly what we're doing, because otherwise they're put in a position where they're at risk of doing something that's inappropriate. And so the clarity and the narrowing of that first portion to those offenses, which are most of greatest concern, was a key for us to feel comfortable with that. But thank you for the question.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 731?
Thank you.
Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 731. I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 731.
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment, Senate Bill 731.
Sentinel Cruz moves this Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 731. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 731 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 731 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I just have a question. I assume we have a fiscal. Is it in this packet somewhere?
It is. We've received it. It's a minimal. And there's no revenue and no fiscal.
I know it was mentioned. Right. I just haven't seen anything.
All right. Any other questions? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. Chair will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on 731. And we're going to go ahead and I'm going to skip. Well, let me just ask, because no one has signed up on the sheet. Was there anyone here who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 740? We'll come back at that because I can provide that in a minute. So what we're going to do is we're going to... All right. Well, yeah, we'll do it real quick. Open hearing on Senate Bill 740. 740 was introduced at a request of a constituent. Basically, what he wanted to make certain is that when you have real property being sold by the sheriff, if there is a street address, instead of just relying exclusively on the legal description, that this street address should also be included for lay individuals to be able to actually understand that what property is in fact being sold by the sheriff. So with that, that's the testimony that you'll be hearing, and we're going to close the public hearing on 740. And now we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, and that looks like our next one's going to be SJR3, and I'll go ahead and open up that public hearing. Bills? Okay. And he has the next one too. All right. We're waiting for council to get here on 740. So I'm going, on SJR 3. So I'm going to recess SJR 3 right now. And Cheyenne, you had some work session items. Oh, here he is. Let's do it that way. All right, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on SJR 3.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 3 is a proposed constitutional amendment. It comes to you from the Judiciary Committee. And the issue involved here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that we have inmates in the institution who are advanced age, extremely ill, and this would facilitate them getting out on a medical discharge early. It's intended to address the issue in the Constitution that sentences passed in open court can only be changed if you go back to court. This would allow the Probation and Parole Board to look at each case individually and make a determination whether to release them. Closing medical expenses for some of these inmates can run as much as $100,000 a week.
All right. I have two individuals that have signed up, Bill Polfo, I believe, and Walt Beglow. And Walt, the way I think we're going to do this, we'll let Bill speak first because he looks like he's down as proponent, and you're probably here for the association in a neutral position.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Bill?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Bill Hafe. I'm the Health Services Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. The joint resolution would allow the Department of Corrections and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to consider additional inmates for medical parole. Currently, inmates who are serving mandatory minimum sentences are precluded from consideration. The resolution would allow the parole board to advance the release date of inmates who are sentenced for a crime other than aggravated murder or murder committed on or after November 1st, 1989. And this language is in Senate Joint Resolution 3's companion bill, Senate Bill 78. To be considered for medical parole, an inmate needs to meet the following criteria: demonstrated an extended course of conduct indicating outstanding reformation, suffers from a severe medical condition, including terminal illness, And is elderly and permanently incapacitated in such a manner that the prisoner is unable to move from place to place without the assistance of another person. We house approximately 14,000 inmates in 14 prisons across the state. We don't anticipate a large number of inmates to be released on medical parole. There are some potential cost savings depending upon the severity of the illness or injury. When an inmate's released, a bed does become available for another inmate. In 2008, 17 inmates asked to be considered and were considered for medical parole. Seven of them had sentence restrictions and were precluded from further consideration. Of the remaining 10, three were eventually released by the parole board. The remaining seven in the group did not meet the criteria. In 2009, 24 inmates were considered. 11 of the 24 had sentence restrictions and could not be given further consideration. Of the remaining 13, three were eventually released. In 2010, none were released. Appropriate housing is one of the considerations prior to them being considered for release. We would not recommend a release without appropriate housing or care plan in place to provide care for the releasing inmate. There are some examples of inmates who have been released in 2008 and 2009. There is no fiscal associated, and thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Walt?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney and also President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm here in that capacity today. Senate Joint Resolution 3 clearly identifies some potential savings at the Department of Corrections, and if carefully crafted and implemented, could deliver those cost savings and also could maintain the public's expectation of making sure those individuals don't reoffend and the public is protected. I raise this when looking at the language here because many of the cases that I've handled, and one of them in particular was one of the worst sex offenders I had was in a wheelchair at the time he committed his offenses, was confined there and was abusing boys. And so it makes it very critical, I think, for us to kind of share our concerns that there are certain sureties in place as we look at this bill and potentially to deliver our support on behalf of it. First, we need to identify the cost savings, but the other points really are relative to, one, we've got to make sure that the defendants can't petition for this, that it's done by the Department of Corrections and the medical authorities that can make these identifications. I think it's important to have kind of oversight from the victim's perspective, too. We've always had that in place through the Board of Post-Prison Supervision and representation through the district attorneys, and so I think that's something we should be cognizant of, aware of. And then, frankly, again, as described, make sure that the bar is set real high, that we clearly define severe medical conditions and permanent incapacitation so that we make sure that the public is protected and they know exactly those that might be eligible for such consideration. So thanks for your time today, and that's our position.
Any questions? All right, got Senator Bonamici and then Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe that District Attorney Bigelow might have raised the question I was going to ask, but I wonder if we could get an answer about what a severe medical condition might be and how and where that would be defined.
Well, as it currently stands, none of the inmates who've been released are still living. Typically, they're at end of life by the time we release them, or the parole board recommends their release and actually releases them. At this point, they're all terminal. So they're all at end of life. So in many cases, some of those who've been released, great deal of the cost has already been spent in trying to save their lives, and they're essentially released to go home, pass with their families.
And will there be some sort of definition in your rules about what is a severe medical condition, so that there's clarity about who can?
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, we can certainly do that. I mean, we have a set of criteria we follow now in bringing those forward. We're not interested in compromising the public safety in it by any stretch of the imagination. We're very judicious about who is considered. And as you could see by those who were brought forward, it's a very small number. And we wouldn't anticipate that number would increase much.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you. This is a constitutional amendment. So I think we really do need to define what a severe medical condition is, perhaps in the text of the amendment. And it says here, who is suffering from a severe medical condition, including terminal illness. Does that mean that they have to be terminally ill, or does that mean that they could be suffering from a severe medical condition or terminally ill? The Lockerbie bomber was severely ill and terminally ill. And he's as healthy as you and I are, so.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, I understand that particular case. Again, all I can tell you is it's difficult to identify any possible circumstance under which a person might be released or considered for it. We did have one individual who ended up being a quadriplegic and essentially end of life, was going to die. It was a question of time, and that was one that under current rules and statute could not be considered. And we ended up spending about $800,000 on specialty care on that individual. That's one that was not terminal at the time, but was clearly incapacitated.
So it could be either?
It could be either, yes.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on SJR 3? Not seeing anyone, we'll close up public hearing. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 428.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 428 comes to you from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. It allows a police officer who's taken a child into protective custody because a child is engaging in acts of prostitution to release the child to the custody of a shelter that has agreed to provide care and services to the children who are victims of sexual exploitation if the police officer has reason to believe that the child is likely to engage in prostitution. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have two amendments before you. One clarifies the shelter does not have custody of the child, even though they may have the child within the shelter, they don't have legal custody. Two, clarifies that the county does not have a shelter facility, or the facility is at capacity, then the juvenile will go through the current juvenile proceedings. Defendants.
All right, thank you. I have three people who have signed up: Janet Arentz, Lynn Haxton, and Rachel Hessmark. Y'all three would come forward, please. Who would like to get started? Be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the committee board. Hello. I am a daughter, a wife, a mother, a friend, a confidant, a trained volunteer, a community leader with the Power Foundation, and a court-appointed special advocate. My name is Rachel Hessmark.
Excellent.
And I am a human trafficking survivor. When I was a teenager at 19 years old, I was tricked by two girls that was introduced to me to the most horrendous man that I would ever meet. I was taken across the country to Boston, where I had no family or friends. I was threatened to work until I could buy back my freedom that I was once born with. They said that if I did not do what I was told, then my family would die because they knew where my family lived. The other girls and I didn't really speak. I tried to call home, but I was threatened to not do it again. I made a mistake later, and still to this day, I do not know what it was. But because my error, I was beat on the streets where I waited for yet another car to pick me up and help me to get one more dollar closer to buying back my freedom. But now I know that he had to push control and to prove it to me, and he had to be the one to show me so that I would know who was in control. I was truly in hell. I would often cry, and I experienced watching women get killed by the men that they served. I was arrested, and I had to lie to save my life. He gave me a script that I had to follow. I watched my traitor beat one of the other girls so bad in our low-class hotel because she had told him that she was pregnant by him. This put the fear of our lives being lost into motion. I knew that I had to get out of there, but I had to be both smart and ignorant about my circumstance. I am only here because of the grace of my God in heaven. Many times I wanted to come home, but I did not have the way to safely leave without the threat of my life or the threat of my family's lives laying on my shoulder and constantly in my mind. The man was so tired of my cries that he was going to sell me to another trader because he could not make me happy enough to stay. I asked him to please don't. He said, well, what do you want? I said, I just want to go home. I cried so much that finally he agreed that my contract had been paid and I was able to buy back my freedom for only $15,000. This was how much he said I was worth. He told the other girls to take me to the Greyhound station and told them that if I tried to come back, that they should beat me so that I could not return. As I boarded the bus with only my clothes on my back and my little bag, I then went to sleep with both eyes closed for the first time in a long time. Thank you, God, I said over and over and over again. It took me 3 days to get home without food or water. A woman asked me if I was hungry, and she fed me. Today, I view her as an angel that was sent to help me. I had nowhere to go and no one to speak to when I returned home. But today, there are human trafficking divisions today that are fighting to help young boys and girls like me to be free. A promise was made to the public 2 years ago that a safe home would be made available for these children and women, but there are still no open doors with warm hearts, with comfortable beds to lay their heads, and psychological and emotional counseling for these children. I stand before you today, or I sit before you today as a survivor, and I speak to you from the bottom of my heart. I encourage and I challenge you not to forget my words, because it happens many places in our state, even not too far from the walls of this building. I ask for this committee to address just one element of human trafficking in Oregon that needs to be mandated immediately, allowing law enforcement to get our children to immediate safety in a facility or safe home. I thank you very much for listening to me today.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I'll go next. Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Haxton. I'm with Youth Rights and Justice, formerly the Juvenile Rights Project, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 428. Ms. Hesmark's statements were very moving and highlight the issues around the state on the commercial sexual exploitation of children. We believe that Senate Bill 428 is consistent with the Juvenile Code, particularly the mandatory child abuse reporting laws. Under the mandatory child abuse definitions, children who are victimized by prostitution are victims of child abuse. We think that Senate Bill 428 allows these children to be taken into protective custody by law enforcement and child welfare. It gives them a clear tool to intervene in their lives, to provide services, support, and shelter for them. It also recognizes that these children are victims and allows us to provide a consistent message to them that they are victims. We want to support them. We want to help them. Because of many years of abuse, even that occurred before they were trafficked, many of these children do not trust adults. By putting this Senate Bill 428 in the statute, it will give them a message from the adults that you can trust us, we're here to help you. It also will take some of the power away from the pimps. The pimps will use any means they can to coerce, manipulate, and force these children into trafficking, including the threat of jail. They will tell the girls that do not give your real name, do not admit you're underage, do not, under any circumstances, tell the police that you have a pimp. Because if you do, you will be arrested and put in jail. By using the protective custody statute, these children can be taken into custody and placed in an appropriate shelter. So we urge you to support Senate Bill 428. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Janet.
Yes, good morning. Janet Ahrens, the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. I submitted some written testimony for you. So briefly, we just want to let you know how much we appreciate all the energy the Senate has put forward to develop a whole series of strategies in which to end sex trafficking in Oregon. My organization represents $180 million worth of services, 7,000 employees, 95,000 kids. 11 of my members, all nonprofit organizations, provide services for runaway and homeless youth. And so I represent their voice as well as the policy of my organization. We are very supportive of legislation we've seen around tougher penalties and also legislation such as 428, which provides services for these youth. Just to echo what Lynn was saying, it's really, really important that we don't put youth in detention and treat them as if they are criminals instead of victims. And so I appreciate the alternative here of getting them into shelter. Also, hopefully, in circumstances in shelter, they're not only safe, but provide assessment and evaluation, identify what their follow-up needs are going to be, and that there's a commitment to get them into the services, other additional services they're going to need. That revolving door of prostitution is not just going to be eliminated through prosecution, but we need a front-end strategy for the system. We do have a rollout system that was established 2 years ago in Oregon that specifically targets first-time runners and family reconciliation work. And I think that those 8 sites around Oregon is an important start for what we need as a statewide system. If we can reduce, if we can keep kids at home, keep them in school, and keep them off the streets, and we've got a much better chance of slowing the number or the pool of potential victims that sex traffickers are clearly looking for. So using, developing that system, regionalizing it, in addition to a model that came out of Multnomah County and some planning that's been done to be able to treat those youth who have become victims of sex trafficking, a combination plus some of the existing runaway and homeless providers would really build us the safety net that we need in order to be able to accomplish what you're trying to do with this bill. And I thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Before you leave, let me ask if there's any questions for the panel.
I have a quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Does anybody here have an update on the funding? There was supposed to be some federal funding for the facility in Portland. Is there an update on that? Anybody knows about it? Thank you.
Rachel, I want to thank you very much for coming forward today. I know it takes a lot for you to come forward and tell your story, but it's very important for us to hear it and be part of our record. So thank you very much.
I thank you for letting it be a part of your record. There are still youth that need our help, and our foundation, the Power Foundation, is willing to. We are boarded with all volunteers, and we are ready to work as volunteers as the first human trafficking safe home that the city or the county has given to the YWCA in East County to do. There's also another home in Northeast Portland that has said they used to be a domestic violence, that has said that they are willing to open up their doors. I can't give the addresses, but there's also another facility in another part of Oregon that has offered to give their home. So there are a lot of willing participants that are stepping forward. We have licensed builders that are willing to work with construction and bring these buildings and homes up to living so we can start to give beds to these children that need them.
Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 428. Just make certain there's no one else that wanted to give testimony that wasn't signed up. I'll close that public hearing. What I'm going to do is I'm going to open up a work session for the purpose of adopting the two amendments. So work session will be open on Senate Bill 428.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 428.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1s into Senate Bill 428. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 428.
Senator Cruz now moves the Dash 2s into Senate Bill 428. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll close the work session on 428. And we're going to move into our last public hearing that we have scheduled, which is Senate Bill 654. But before I do that, I just want to, I should have done this earlier in the day, but the bills that are set for work sessions, 425, 426, 429, and 430, and including 428 that we just did a partial work session, those are going to be carried over till later this week. We need to have some discussions on the package as a whole. In And before we move them all, we need to make sure we have everything in place. And so I'm not sure what day it will be set over, but I'm assuming the end of this week is what we'll shoot for, or the very beginning of next. So with that, we'll go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 654. And Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 654 comes from the Committee on General Government, Consumer and Small Business Protection. The chair, members of the committee, requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission prepare a racial and ethnic impact statement describing the racial and ethnic impact of proposed legislation on criminal offender population and the recipients of human services.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. And ma'am, thank you for being here. So we have a rep and we've got a senator. Who's going first?
I would like to lead off, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, Senate District 22. Senate Bill 654 seeks to address minority overrepresentation in the criminal justice and child welfare systems. A national organization that works closely with the Sentencing Project prepared a nice summary of what racial impact statements do when it wrote, "Racial impact statements are a new tool developed to estimate the disparate racial impacts of criminal justice and child welfare policies in much the same way that fiscal statements describe the budgetary effects of other policies. This allows legislators, or in the case of this bill, also the voters, to make an informed consideration of the racial impacts when crafting solutions to crime, delinquency, and child welfare, and helps ensure that racial justice costs are included in the public dialogue regarding criminal justice and child welfare choices." So if we agree that minority overrepresentation is something to be concerned about, I think we as a legislature should try our best not to make things worse. I know in my community, the police come under a lot of criticism for executing laws that we create, and this would give us the opportunity as a body and a legislator in particular could request a racial impact statement, hit the pause button, and determine if this is the proper way for us to go forward or if we might want to consider other ways to get to the public safety end result that might not exacerbate minority overrepresentation. A lot of people wanted to testify on the bill, Mr. Chair, but we decided to keep it to three in consideration of your time. I do think it's important for me to just go through the four aspects of the bill to get that on the record about what the bill does, though, and then I will pass off to the rest of our panel. The first section allows legislators to request an impartial, simple, racial and ethnic impact statement for legislation relating to criminal justice or child welfare as defined in ORS 419B.1 or ORS 418.005. Secondly, the bill will include, to the degree available, information on crime victims' racial and ethnic composition, and including information about crime victims and how they would be impacted by this legislation was very important to the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and it's my understanding, according to their representation in the building, that the DAs are now neutral on the bill because of bringing that additional information into this legislation. This would make us the first in the nation to include crime victim information in racial and ethnic impact statements. The third section of the bill allows for these statements to be available related to ballot measures. And the fourth section would ensure that various agencies' grant applications, those that are giving out grants, take into account racial impact as well. And this was an idea that was borrowed from Iowa, with the purpose being to get agencies to also think about how their grant application processes might affect minority overrepresentation. You should have received electronically some testimony from the Sentencing Project that shows what other states have done in this regard, as well as some testimony from the Iowa Legislative Fiscal Office. Iowa was the first state to implement this, a state that has demographics comparable to what Oregon does, but has also a pretty significant minority overrepresentation. Included in the LFO statement is examples of what these look like. What a racial impact statement would look like. And if you look at her attachment, and this is the testimony Beth Glenstra from the Iowa Legislative Fiscal Office. You'll note that these are very simple statements, about one paragraph, that takes a look at what the impact has been on similar crimes to project what the impact might be on future crimes. I think we would be the first in the nation also to apply this to child welfare policy. Iowa does not do that. So that being said, Mr. Chair, I'd like to now just hand it off to Rep. Frederick, who will make a couple of comments, and then to Midge Purcell from the Urban League, and we'll let you get back to your business.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My name is Lou Frederick. I am State Representative for District 43, North and Northeast Portland. Wanted to just say a couple of quick words. It would be hard to overstate the concerns of folks in my community have about what is, not what is what appears to be, but what in fact is a clear discrepancy based on race and the justice system in this state. Any approach, especially the approach in this bill that addresses the racial impact of new policies, will go a long ways towards the issue of justice. Several bills introduced in the Senate and the House are attempts to bring, that I've introduced in the Senate and the House, are attempts to bring down the tension that presently exists. And tension's a nice way of putting it. Frankly, there's a fear that exists in my community and in the law enforcement community as well. Anything we can do to address those issues is going to be very helpful. This bill is a good step towards that. And I will end my comments on just that.
Thank you.
Good morning. Chair Przanski. Pardon me, a bit froggy. Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Urban League of Portland. And I'd like to share some thoughts as you deliberate Senate Bill 654. I think my colleagues have ably demonstrated that racial and ethnic minorities continue to be overrepresented in our criminal justice system and in the child welfare system. I wasn't going to blind you with statistics, but I think it's important to note that African Americans are 6 times more likely to be in prison than white Oregonians. And there are similar disproportionate numbers for children in the child welfare system. The Urban League has been working with a number of organizations and communities of color around the state to reduce and eliminate these disparities. We believe that racial impact statements provide one concrete step in balancing these inequities in our criminal justice system and child welfare system by scrutinizing a bill before it's passed to avoid disparate impact and unintended consequences. We're really excited that this bill includes child welfare because we believe that racial impact statements will help the governor's office and the DHS identify policy and budget priorities that will reduce unacceptable racial disparities in the foster care system. There are similarly grim statistics around the child welfare system, but behind those statistics are the families that are impacted by this disparate impact in our child welfare system. The Urban League has a senior services center, and some of them are grandparents raising their grandchildren. And we get calls all the time from grandparents who inexplicably cannot gain custody of their children. And they suffer terribly as they see them being taken into the foster care system when they could have, with the right support, remain in their homes and remain in their community. So we believe legislation should be aimed at increasing the probability that children of color remain in their community with relatives that can support them. And finally, we believe that racial impact statements are cost-effective in the long term. It will reduce the unnecessary cost of long-term child care placements, and also we believe that we can avoid the high cost of incarcerating nonviolent offenders that otherwise could be served in alternative, less expensive programs that lead to better long-term outcomes. So finally, we want to promote the long-term health and well-being of Oregon's children and families. We need to ensure that our system is using the proper interventions when upholding public safety and effectively delivering services to all Oregon's families. So we urge you to support this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for any of our panelists? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here and for your testimony. I'm trying to figure out logistically how this works, and I'm looking at the Iowa statement, and I wonder, I think I'll ask Senator Shields, do you happen to know how often these are requested? Because if we requested them for basically every bill in the committee, that would probably be a workload, but is it just for specific bills that a member has identified as possibly problematic?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, yes, they put into their statutes what we have that a legislator could request it, and that has limited the number of the amount of the workload that Iowa has had to engage in. I think, if I recall correctly, they might have had five or six in the legislative session.
All right, let me just put on the record, I've talked to Senator Shields about this. I've also talked to CJC, who would be one of the agencies that would be impacted. The chair has an amendment that's being drafted that would limit this to just citizen initiatives, referrals, and citizen initiatives to start off. My biggest concern with a tight budget that we have is if we want to get something out there, let's see what we can get out there that actually will open the door for this in the future without having it die in ways and means because we don't have the money to get it started. So this would be a much more narrow approach, but it'd be one that, let's say, get us going in the direction we need to go. And so that's going to be up for discussion before we conclude on this bill. So thank you all very much for coming forward. Is there anyone else except Brian? I know you wanted to testify. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on 654?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brian DeLeichmann representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Unfortunately, Kevin Campbell had to leave and gave me blessing to also express his concerns. Actually, Chair Przanski, with that amendment, I believe we probably would alter our position. I did not mark up whether we're supporting or opposed, but we have the same concerns about the volume of bills that deal with criminal statutes and what this would cause as far as the fiscal. And so we will anticipate looking at that amendment and come back and talk to you later. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 654. And we're going to move into some of the work session items that we have. My understanding, we have basically three that are available to be done. What I'm going to ask for is on Senate Bill 411, we had passed this out. We had the two different amendments that we had drafted. We did not have a fiscal with them being, quote unquote, combined. But we had them separately, even though we knew there was not going to be any difference. We've been told we have to do a motion to reconsider the vote that we took on Senate Bill 411, and then we can adopt it under the guise as what the President's office wants us to do. So, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 411 as amended.
Senator Cruz moves that we reconsider the vote that we passed Senate Bill 411 and move to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order. I will now open a work session on Senate Bill 411. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we now have the fiscal for the Dash 7s, which as we knew last week did not change the fiscal impact statement, which was $787,126, which means that we, as last week, have to probably refer the bill to the Resident Committee.
All right, so before we take that motion, do we need to undo the other amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no. We've adopted the Dash 2, the Dash 4, and the Dash 7. And as I had a note last week that basically that the Dash 7, they did not have the fiscal impact statement, but it was not going to change the fiscal impact.
All right, so we have the Dash 7s in as well.
We've adopted the Dash 2s, 4s, and 7, Mr. Chair. We now have the fiscal impact as it relates to the Dash 7.
Then we'll take a motion for the bill with the understanding that we need to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 411 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 411 as amended by the three amendments 2, 4, and 7 go to the floor with a due pass recommendation, also with a request from the President's office for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means based on its potential fiscal impact. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Since it's going to Ways and Means, we do not need a carrier.
Right.
And so we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 411. And then our next one we're going to do is Senate Bill 347. I'll open up a work session on 347.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 347 was previously heard on March 17th. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. It's the one that exempts the records of individuals and their family members who were seeking assistance from domestic violence service providers from being subject to records, public records requests. Records maintained by domestic violence service providers, resource centers, or shelters operated by or in partnership with a public entity are subject to disclosure as public records, and this bill would allow such records to be kept confidential. The Dash 1 amendment simply adds an emergency clause.
All right. Chair will take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 347.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill the Dash 1s into Senate Bill 347. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 347 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 347 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And did I have a request for someone who wanted to carry this one?
Well, Senator Rosenbaum.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Okay.
I actually did request it, but if Senator Rosenbaum would like
so
to carry it.
So what we're going to do is we're going to list Senator Rosenbaum as the carrier. Second carrier will be Senator Dingfelder if Senator Rosenbaum does not want to carry this one. With that, we'll close the work session on 347. And we're going to open up our last, we may have two other ones. Senate Bill 385, work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 385 has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. It was previously heard on March 10th. This is the bill that modifies exclusions from the augmented estate to distinguish irrevocable transfers of property before death and transfers of property on or after death with written joinder of consent of surviving spouse, and to include property held by either spouse in a solely fiduciary capacity. This was brought by the Estate Planning and Administration section of the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Law Commission jointly. It's a follow-up to House Bill 3077 in 2009, which went into effect January 1st. That House Bill 3077 was a long and complex measure. It represented almost a decade of cooperative effort by the Commission to update Oregon's elective share statutes. And this bill, Senate Bill 385, makes a number of technical and corrective modifications to resolve inconsistencies noticed by practitioners since the bill went into effect.
All right.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 385 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 385 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Bonamici, will you be so kind to carry?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You're
I was hoping that that
would we need the legal this all. So
like,
with
oh.
that, we're going to have to go ahead and close the work session on 385. Senator Bonamici, chocolates will be available at the office. All right, let's see. I had 387 that was not ready because we didn't have a revenue statement. Have we received that since we've been in today?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so we'll be carrying that one over as well.
Mr.
I've already
Chair.
Mentioned the other four that were right after that, 425, 426, 429, 430, along with 428 will all be brought back either toward the end of this week or the very beginning of next, depending on how we can get it scheduled with notice. And the last one we had was Senate Bill 77, and I understand that one is not ready because we do not have a revenue statement.
Chair, according to here, we have the notes here. We do have it has a minimal fiscal impact. I know you have to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, and this is Drew Johnson's bill. Provides that inmate may not bring action against public policy unless inmate has exhausted the administrative remedies. The chair, members of the committee, I understand that the amendments are consensus amendments, I think. I'm trying to look at Andrea Meyer
well,
in the back.
What we're going to do is after 10 o'clock, we're going
to
carry this one over.
Wednesday.
We'll carry this one over till Wednesday, I understand. So that's what we're going to do since I'm not going to keep my committee any longer. Anything else we need to go over?
Did we need to adopt this to make the statements? It'll just come in on the dash one, I guess, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we already have the fiscal. I think it relates to the dash one. I'm not sure, but I'm sure we'll have it by Wednesday.
Okay.
All right. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close for today. My understanding is we need to be here at 8:30. Any council saying no? Don't see anyone shaking their head. So we're adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30.